from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Controversial Fox News CEO Roger Ailes started out in television as a producer for The Mike Douglas Show, a daytime variety program better known for musical acts and guests like Bob Hope than for politics. But one day, then-presidential candidate Richard Nixon appeared on his show, and Ailes used the opportunity to score a position as Nixon's television consultant. Gabriel Sherman's new book, The Loudest Voice in the Room, traces Ailes' career from those early days to his role as the pioneering and, according to Sherman's account, paranoid mastermind behind Fox News' dominance. Welcome, Gabriel Sherman. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've taken on quite an enemy here, because now I guess he is your enemy, even though there seems to be some conflict about how available he was in terms of your talking to him or interviewing him, and I want to get into that with you. But let me just say, because there are, believe it or not, maybe listeners here who don't know who Roger Ailes is or was. He was an advisor to President Nixon and to President Reagan and to President George W. Bush, and he was also the man who launched cable news, Fox Network, back in 1996 with the help of Rupert Murdoch. I want to get right to Nixon, though, because that's such an important seminal fact in his development. He was admittedly the progenitor of Fox News. You talk about his influence on politics, and we'll get into all that. But when you think of Nixon, you think of a guy who is at war with people, has enemies list, dirty tricks, sees himself as a political victim. This is Roger Ailes, too, isn't it?
That's a fascinating point, and you can really learn so much about Roger Ailes through his work for Richard Nixon, because he learned two lessons which he applied directly to Fox News. Number one, Ailes learned as Nixon's television consultant that you could use television to control the image of a politician. You could advance a political agenda through the medium of television. And Ailes did that by perfecting the camera angles, the lighting. Every time Nixon appeared at one of these staged town hall events that the Nixon campaign was doing in 1968, Ailes made sure Nixon looked as warm and human on screen as possible. And
so he couldn't get the jowls with John F. Kennedy, unfortunately.
Yeah. And it reversed
the first TV debate, actually, I think it was, for a presidential
1960,
debate.
Yes. So they introduced the new Nixon versus the old Nixon. The second thing Ailes learned, which you point out, is this world, this idea that it's the campaign versus the media, that the media is the enemy, that journalists are the enemy. Because I interviewed Ailes' colleagues on the Mike Douglas Show and his childhood friends, and no one that I spoke to really gave me the sense that he had a political ideology or a view of the media prior to Nixon.
Well, didn't Joe McGinnis, the guy who did Selling a President, say he didn't have a political thought in his head until he got to Nixon?
Yeah, and so it's this. It was sort of this hothouse environment where Ailes soaked up this worldview and this ideology that stayed with him ever since.
And it also includes what I suppose could be, I don't mean to give this as a clinical diagnosis, but paranoia and enemies lists and all of that sort of thing, and also a kind of attack politics. I mean, you think about Nixon, you think about Helen Gahagan Douglas and Jerry Voorhees. I mean, his career was built on attacking those.
And wedge issues, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and dividing groups from another to build a coalition. And Ailes learned all of those things. And it's ironic because some of the people I interviewed who are closest to Ailes now at Fox News really described him as more Nixonian than Richard Nixon, if that is even possible. But he has this obsession with loyalty, with pitting his underlings against each other, this surveillance culture where people are spying on each other. It really is an analog to the Nixon White House.
So you write about Ailes in terms of being this extraordinarily powerful figure. In fact, I think when he met Barack Obama, whom he obviously despises, he said President Obama said the most powerful man in the world. But was he really as culpable for the kind of polarization that we see now? I mean, to a great extent, that's kind of your thesis in some part.
You know, Ailes really, his life traces the arc of television in American culture. And through cable news, Ailes cleaved American culture into the situation we have now, where every media outlet really has to choose a side. There's one of the fascinating episodes in my book is actually showing how the other cable news networks responded to Fox News's success. And while everyone associates MSNBC now with progressive politics, after 9/11, MSNBC actually veered further to the right and tried to out-Fox Fox because they were so panicked. The executives at NBC were so panicked that Fox News was taking over the news business, they tried to copy Ailes. And so you see that not only is Ailes' power rendered through the audience that he's built at Fox News, but he's forced the other media outlets to change their programming strategies. And now we have a media landscape in America where politics and ideology is infused with the news business.
And it's almost become a political party, Fox News, as you argue, yeah?
The end of my book argues that Fox News has surpassed the Republican Party. Ailes has disdain for the Republican Party. He jokes to his executives that the GOP couldn't organize a one-car funeral. And in fact, he set upon his mission to run Mitt Romney's 2012 media campaign. He thought that the GOP didn't have what it took to go hard on Obama. So Ailes used Fox News as his personal megaphone to attack the president. And really, it's what's fascinating is this is a
moment. Can I just use his language for a moment
here?
Because you quoted it. He said Romney should rip Obama's face off.
Yeah.
I mean, and yet, to a great extent, he did not like Romney. In fact, I'm looking at your book here. He finds flaws in everyone, said a confidant. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich was a blank, male genitalia. Former Senator Rick Santorum was a nobody. Former Governor Mike Huckabee couldn't raise a nickel. Former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin was an idiot. And the two adults in the room, unaffiliated with Fox, former Governors John Huntsman and Mitt Romney, were less than impressive. He didn't like any of these candidates. He liked Chris Christie, I guess, though.
He did, and General David Petraeus. Interesting to note, both those men decided to sit out the race. And it's really interesting that Ailes essentially damaged the very party that he has devoted his life to serving. You know, the circus that he puts on Fox News has really become the image of the Republican Party. And it's a divisive image and a message that turns off many moderate and centrist voters. And so what my book shows is that essentially and ultimately, politics and television are two very different things. And making television entertaining and making television news a circus, while it's a great business and builds a huge audience in cable television, does not help you win an election.
Gabriel Sherman, our guest, he's contributing editor of New York Magazine. His book is called The Loudest Voice in the Room, and he will be speaking tonight at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco at 7 p.m. He's going to be here with us for a while, and you have an opportunity to join in here, especially if you have some strong sentiments one way or the other about Roger Ailes or Fox News. We'd like to hear from you. If you have questions about Roger Ailes, Gabriel Sherman's done yeoman work here and really telling his story, that is Roger Ailes' story, and telling it, I think, with some journalistic distance that you often don't find in Fox News, even though you hear fair and balanced all the time. We welcome your phone calls, and you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, and please feel free to participate in the program. Again, the toll-free number, which is yours now, is 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. Does he see himself, you think, Gabriel, as a kind of a savior? I mean, he wanted to not only make the next president, create the next president, but also this whole attitude of being sort of the man who's going to be pushing the republic in the direction it ought to go and standing behind it.
I think that's one of the things that makes Ailes such a compelling character, is that this transcends the news business. This transcends politics. It gets to the very question about what it is to be an American. What is America? What is our country about? And Ailes sees himself, he talks of himself as someone who is trying to save the republic. And that, in a certain way, I write in the book with a bit of sadness at the end, because he's a man who sees his vision of America slipping away. You know, the image of a white Christian man who grew up in Northeast Ohio. He was born in 1940. That vision of America, the post-war vision, is changing, and he doesn't like the multicultural image of America that's replacing it.
He doesn't like liberals. He doesn't like progressives. He doesn't like the counterculture. I mean, he's on board with a lot of the people who became sort of acolytes of his, one could argue, but they were people who took their own stance and in some ways even locked horns with him. I'm thinking about people like obviously Glenn Beck, but also Bill O'Reilly and the famous people from Fox News. But they all see themselves as sort of preservers of the American dream.
Exactly. And that is why this book is really a journey through post-war America and getting to this idea of what our country is. The debates, the cultural tumult of the late 60s is really what Ailes' struggle is all about.
But, you know, you've been criticized for making Ailes much more powerful than he really is. And to some degree, I think that's a criticism that I'd like you to head it, at least confront it head on, because he's a TV guy, you know, and Fox News certainly has impact. There's no denying that. But to say that he's really been a major counterculture, a major force in our culture, and also the major responsibility for a lot of the polarizations on Capitol Hill today, or the partisanship, may be taking it too far.
Well, his power is evidenced in two ways. And that line of criticism, I feel, doesn't actually reflect what's in the book. The peak of Ailes' power, which my book shows, was in the middle of the last decade, the midpoint of the Bush years. The post 9/11 period through the war in Iraq was really the moment when Fox News dominated the agenda in America. Through the recount, the 2004 election, Ailes really propelled the George W. Bush presidency. But since Hurricane Katrina and the rise of Barack Obama and the sinking fortunes of the Republican Party, Ailes' power has waned, and he failed to get Mitt Romney elected. So my book ends on this idea that Ailes is in a period of decline. Fox News is in a period of decline. But to your point about the polarization, Ailes' career is much bigger than Fox News. And in fact, I would say his legacy in American politics is the idea that attack politics, sideshow politics, the politics of personal destruction is what he's going to leave behind. He was, in the 1980s, the preeminent attack strategist, political hitman of the Republican Party. And I would say he was so successful that the Democrats copied him. His attack ads for candidates like George H.W. Bush, Mitch McConnell, Phil Graham, and others were so devastating in their use of humor, crass distortion, that he propelled those candidates to office. And it's ironic that the Democrats learned from Ailes, and Bill Clinton's famous war room in 1992 was a direct response to Ailes' attack lines in 1988. Barack Obama, in many ways, in 2012, ran an Ailesian campaign against Mitt Romney, painting Romney as an out-of-touch plutocrat. So Ailes' legacy is that our politics is now all about sideshow issues, personal attacks, drumming up controversy. I mean, Ailes has said in interviews that the media only cares about three things: gaffes, mistakes, and controversy. And so that is what our political culture is about. And that is how he has divided the country. And we are not about substance. We are not about issues. We are about controversy and entertainment and spectacle.
That's a lot of popular culture, too. Yeah. It can't all be put on those rather wide shoulders of Roger Ailes, who always draws attention to his size the same way that Chris Christie does. And there are people who lampoon him and make fun of him because of that. He also talks about often how unhappy he is. And those people who follow Ailes or who know about him or who are aware of him often see him as a bit of a buffoon or a blowhard. I mean, even people in the Republican Party who, you know, he's been behind. This is a guy, for example, who has – does he still think that climate change doesn't exist and that it's a worldwide conspiracy to control the resources of the United States?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me get some callers on here and find out what our listeners have to say. Daniel, you're first up. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I'm just wondering, you know, the guest, I apologize, I forgot the name.
Gabriel Sherman.
Mr. Sherman, thank you. Talked about kind of MSNBC and CNN trying to do Fox News-ish type things. And frankly, from my perspective, they're just bad at it. So what makes Roger Ailes so good at it with Fox News? What's his secret? I can take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for the call. It may be the same secret of why commercial radio is so successful with Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and all these. I mean, there's an audience for that kind of slanting of the news, if you will.
Two things. Yes, there is an audience of people who self-identify as conservative who wants news that validates their worldview. The second thing that Ailes does that, as the listener points out, MSNBC and CNN fail to do is that he has almost a savant-like ability to choose anchors and talent that are authentic, that jump through the screen and connect with the audience on an emotional level. People who watch Fox News all day really believe that the anchors like Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, the morning show hosts on Fox and Friends are almost like their friends. I mean, it is almost this personal connection that they
develop. Don't people feel that way about Good Morning America and those hosts too?
They do, in a certain sense. And that's a testament to Ailes as a TV guy, you know, coming up through the ranks of daytime television in the 60s. He learned that television is about emotional resonance and having talent connect with the viewers. MSNBC and CNN just do not produce television at the level that Fox does. It's almost a technical issue that they are just not as talented as a television producer as Ailes is.
You, by the way, can join us with Gabriel Sherman by emailing us forum@kqed.org or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or calling us at 866-733-6786. Michael is with us now from San Jose. Michael, you're on.
Yeah, well, maybe that is a matter. It's a matter of emotional connection because, not to be too stereotypical, but I was raised in a Jewish American household, and I find Fox a completely alien feeling world to me, and none of the anchors seem sympathetic. And I've heard, for example, they're making fun of Obama for being a university professor, which would have been unthinkable in my household growing up.
Well, excuse me, Michael. Roger Ailes has said that President Obama never held a job. He was just a community organizer. So the fact that President Obama served in the academic world as well, I guess, doesn't count as a job for Roger Ailes. Yeah.
I guess the question more basically is, does, and I guess I'm thinking of this because I'm reading an interesting book about Fritz Kuhn recently, does Mr. Ailes consider anyone who's not a white Christian American to be really an American?
Well, I think it's hard to get in his head. I'm a reporter, not a novelist, so I'm not trying to get into his head. I can only talk about what he says. And really the way he speaks of it is that this idea, like, for example, someone who works with him told me he does not like the phrase African American. He believes that black people in America, African Americans, should define themselves as American. He doesn't like this notion of having a second cultural affiliation. And so really, I feel like it's his vision of America. And if you're not part of that white Christian male tradition, you're kind of on notice. You have to prove that you are not trying to subvert the American identity. It's a skepticism he has towards these other groups, whether it's African-Americans, gays, lesbians. It's this view that you have to demonstrate that you are on board and not trying to subvert this idea of...
We're Americans. We're not supposed to have hybrid identity.
Exactly.
But
that's
he's not
point.
Father Coughlin. I mean, no. I mean, even though Father Coughlin, as you point out in your book, along with Walter Winchell, may have paved the way for Roger Ailes. And Michael, thank you for your question. You got a lot of heat for this book, huh?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think I was not fully aware of what I was taking on. You know, I thought Ailes was the most compelling story in media. He's a fascinating character. His life traces the arc of the rise and eventual fall of television. So I thought he was this great vehicle to tell the story, and by taking it on, I became a target of the right wing. I was smeared on conservative websites and blogs. I received a death threat at home on the phone. People bought Google ads out against my name that linked to sites smearing my reputation. So it really, I became a political target, which as a reporter was a foreign place to be because I am not the story. I've written about Democrats, I've written about Republicans, I've written about the New York Times, I've written about... You know, all different subjects, Wall Street banks. I just try to go to where the story is.
Fox News says these charges are false, though. They're on record as saying just what you said is false.
Okay.
Well, I mean, but also, yeah. Getting back to the previous caller, you do raise some charges in your book about Ailes' anti-Semitism as well as sexual behavior.
Yes, and there's a lot of explosive revelations that are based on documentary evidence, on-the-record sources. It's interesting to point out that Ailes and Fox have not denied any specifics of the reporting in my book. They've issued blanket denials in regards to the anti-Semitism allegation, which for your listeners, I can just explain for a moment. Before Ailes got to Fox News in 1996, he was a top executive at NBC. He was the president of CNBC, the business channel, and he was in a heated office rivalry with a colleague. And the tensions between him and this colleague got so extreme that Ailes allegedly called him a little Jew something. And I don't know if I can say it on your airwaves.
Don't.
But I won't. But your listeners can use their imagination. But it was the allegation was serious enough that NBC commissioned an internal investigation. They hired a lawyer from a very prestigious Manhattan law firm to investigate the matter. And the lawyer believed that the allegations were true. And now Ailes denies it, but I've seen these reports, I've seen these documents, and they're chilling allegations. And Ailes has not denied it in my book. He just says, well, that's not true, but he's not exactly saying what his version of events is. And I think that's telling because it's an effort, I think, to distract from the fundamentals of my book, which is that it's rigorously reported. It's the product of 3 years of research. And my only intention with this book was to try to provide a measured and nuanced account of who Roger Ailes is and how his life has affected Americans, whether they watch Fox News or not.
One of the most telling things is just how he comports himself in the town he lives in.
That's an amazing story. It's an episode that I tell at the end of the book. He moved about 60 miles north of Manhattan to a small town called Garrison, New York. It's a beautiful area in the Hudson Highlands. It's right across the Hudson River from the West Point Military Academy. And Ailes and his wife bought the local newspaper in 2008. And it was a sleepy small-town paper known for its quirkiness, its coverage of the local schools. And Ailes turned it essentially into a print version of Fox News and divided the community. The community, which, you know, had kind of gotten along. There were political differences, but they simmered at a low level. All of a sudden, there was, you know, open conflict between different groups. And it's a fascinating microcosm of what he has done to the country through media. And I really think it's an episode that reveals who he is as a man.
Well, like you said, you're not a novelist, you're a journalist. Sometimes there's a thin line between the two, admittedly. But what does your gut tell you about Roger Ailes and journalism? Does he care about journalism in, you know, the best sense of getting the news stories out or just getting the news stories fair and balanced?
Absolutely not. I don't believe Ailes thinks that journalism is separate from – he sees it as politics by another means. And I'll give you an example of this. In 1988, he was George H.W. Bush's chief media strategist. And Bush 41 was going to an interview with Dan Rather. This was during the campaign. It was at the height of the campaign when the questions about Bush's role in Iran-Contra were swirling. And on the limo ride over to the interview, Bush and Ailes are in the car, and Ailes is coaching him. And Ailes says to Bush, "Don't accept the premise of anything Dan Rather says to you. Don't legitimize any of his questions, even if they're right." And I think that exchange is so telling because you have Ailes.
This you got from someone who actually overheard the conversation.
Yes, and this has been reported before. This is I interviewed Craig Fuller, George H.W. Bush's chief of staff, who was in the limousine at the time. But this account is so telling because Ailes is essentially telling Bush, don't accept the legitimacy of a journalist's question. A journalist does not have a legitimate role to ask you a question. You can spin, you can dodge and weave. Rather than saying, this is a serious issue, Iran-Contra, we're going to engage with it, I'm going to give you the talking points of how you can give your point of view, he's essentially saying, just don't even listen to Rather.
But it may have something to do with Dan Rather being perceived as somewhat of a liberal, too.
Of course, but I think Ailes, his entire life, has been a TV producer, a political strategist, and a PR man. He is not a journalist. I don't think he thinks of himself as a journalist, and I don't think he thinks that journalists like myself and others really are serving a role in American democracy. He sees us as political opponents by another means.
Listeners writing in here, one of our listeners says, I don't think it's overly optimistic to say that Fox News's shelf life will soon expire amid massive demographic changes in the United States. The melanization of America and the passing of white baby boomers makes Fox and the GOP short-termers at this point. Another listener, Kelly, says, Roger Ailes' paranoia and delusion has ironically greatly contributed to, if not completely caused, the decline of this country. How can we reverse the damage that he's done to our journalism and our country? I don't know if that's your province, Gabriel Sherman, but the future of Fox, let's go to that.
Mm-hmm. It's an open question. My book ends on this image of Fox as an aging audience. The median age of Ailes' viewers are in the late 60s. He's unable, or at least has been unable, to recruit younger viewers. He has disinterest in the internet. Fox does not have a thriving online presence. They're not really big into new media, Twitter, all of that stuff. So as Ailes' audience's ages, it's really unclear how he's going to replace them with a new demographic. He's made, you know, kind of intimations that he wants to reach out to a Latino audience, but his views on immigration are so extreme that it's unclear about how Fox could even appeal to a rising Latino.
Well, that's the problem the Republican Party has,
and
too.
It's an analog. It's a parallel to the challenges that the current Republican Party, which is essentially a white coalition of populist social conservatives and business Republicans face. They have to appeal to an America that's changing every day.
Let me read some more emails that are coming in. Stephen writes, Ailes was successful at decimating the four most important functions of the press in a free society, holding government leaders accountable to the people, publicizing issues that need attention, educating citizens so they can make informed decisions, and connecting people with each other in civil society. Ailes' brilliance, if you can call it that, is that he managed to work in a way that was diametrically opposed to these four functions while convincing millions of Fox viewers that he was working in support of those goals. In the process, he's helped to create a small army of the most ill-informed citizens on the planet. Jerry writes, I knew Roger in his pre-Fox days when he was a wannabe theater producer. I'm a liberal, but I liked him despite his politics. He was blunt, profane, and full of bluster, but a surprisingly personable guy. And you heard this about Ailes too, didn't you?
Yeah, I write in detail about his interlude in the 1970s as a Broadway producer and an impresario. And it's a fascinating chapter in his life. Many of his closest friends and colleagues of that period were liberals, were actually activist members of the American left. His co-producer, Kermit Bloomgarden, who produced Arthur Miller's work, Lillian Hellman, I mean, a real legend of the American stage, was an activist member of the American left. And I think that shows that in that period, Ailes' paranoia and his suspicion of liberals and outsiders had not consumed him, and he was willing to forge these relationships.
He hadn't met Nixon yet.
Well, it was actually right after Nixon. He was trying to get out of politics. He wanted to be a stage producer, and it didn't work out for him, and that propelled him back into the right wing.
Here's a listener, though, who says, aren't a large percentage of Fox watchers lefties who tune in simply to watch the enemy or get emotionally riled? That's a good point.
I don't think it's a large—I think there is a subset, and then I think the rest of the liberals get their Fox through watching Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert have a field day with them.
And Ron writes, I feel the biggest disservice that Fox News and some others have done is that I now view the TV news as primarily only entertainment, so laced with opinion that it cannot be trusted. The primary purpose seems to be to incite outrage.
I would agree with that.
Well, the battle continues, huh? Mm-hmm. You're not going to hear the last from the Ailes people or the Ailes supporters, I guess, as your book continues to circulate.
Yeah, I think... you know, Ailes himself has been very quiet, which I feel is an interesting... strategy, because in the run-up to the book, you know, in fact, he commissioned a sort of a hagiography. He teamed up with a writer who had written a glowing biography of Rush Limbaugh to rush out a book last February before mine. And I think it's reflective of his obsession with trying to control his own story.
Well, the book, again, is the loudest voice in the room, which makes me think of Grace Paley. She wrote a story called The Loudest Voice in her early collection. Contributing editor at New York Magazine and author Gabriel Sherman, who will also be speaking tonight at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco. That starts at 7 p.m. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, our listeners, for being with us. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Coming up in forums next hour, we're going to talk with Daniel Jones, who edits the Modern Love column in the New York Times, which you read on Sunday in their style section. He has a book out all about love called Love Illuminated. And want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.